Welcome to the In Context War Report, produced by MDR Productions, Inc. The In Context War Report is broadcast at noon on the fourth Monday of the month on WPKN, 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming at WPKN.org. Our website is incontextreport.com. I'm your host, Ken McDermott Rowe, and I'm joined by the War Report's military affairs commentator, Marshawn McDermott Rowe. Hello, Marshawn.
Hello, Ken. Great to be back.
Our producer, Gus Canavero, is away on assignment. In the War Report, we report on recent developments in war and geopolitics around the world. By placing these developments in historical context, we show how they affect global stability and U.S. national security. A little background on this series. Back in 2006, I created a series entitled History Counts, in which I shed light on important events that have been ignored or misrepresented in the history books. For example, we did a show with William Pepper, the attorney for the family of Martin Luther King. Mr. Pepper proved in a civil trial in Memphis, Tennessee in 1999 that Reverend King was killed not by James Ray, as the government claimed, but rather by a large number of perpetrators, the majority of whom worked for the government. This shows, and other on similar subjects, are available for free listening at historycounts.org. In 2010, Gus Canavero and I created the new series, In Context, in which we explored a wide variety of subjects from government surveillance to genetically modified foods. Over time, we came to see that the greatest need in the media was for a critical and detailed examination of U.S. military and foreign policy. So we created the In Context War Report, where we combine independent reporting on current wars and geopolitics with history and other contextually important background information. Let's start today's show with a review of some important developments around the world. Mark Lippert, the U.S. ambassador to South Korea, was recently savagely attacked by a knife-wielding anti-American South Korean nationalist. Marshawn, does this attack indicate that there is significant South Korean opposition to the large U.S. military presence there?
I don't think so, at least at this stage, by and large, because most South Koreans seem to support the U.S. military presence. That is due to the fact that South Korea, on the one hand, is hemmed in between China and North Korea on the one side and Japan on the other. Now, while the Japanese are anti-North Korean and anti-Chinese, they also have a very strained relationship with the South Koreans because, lest we forget, Korea became a Japanese colony around the turn of the century. The South Koreans don't have much trust or love of the Japanese. So really, in their eyes, the United States is their only real friend. So I don't believe that it was simply a discontented South Korean nationalist. The other thing is that he had a history of attacking diplomats. He had attacked the Japanese diplomat with a brick, missed him and hit his aide. He did have a history of dissent. But I think it's entirely possible that this was an incident egged on by North Korean agents. I mean, as it's been known for a very long time, North Koreans have a lot of agents working within South Korea, and certainly would make much more sense to send some guy who might be a little off his rocker on a more or less suicide mission after the U.S. ambassador, because unlike the large, heavy object that was thrown at the Japanese ambassador, this had a very clear intent to kill. I think it could have very much been egged on by or encouraged or even ordered by the North Koreans. It benefits North Koreans, and that demonstrates that the U.S. is fundamentally an impotent power as they see it, because, you know, lest we forget, the North Koreans sank a South Korean warship, killed 40 South Korean sailors, and the U.S. told the South Koreans, no, you can't do anything. And then this North Koreans shelled a South Korean island, killed two South Korean Marines and a South Korean civilian, and still they were told to do nothing. Now, this is a direct attack on a U.S. ambassador by what appears to be an agent of North Korea, and the U.S. is again doing nothing. So it demonstrates, it's a way for the North Koreans to try to demonstrate to the South Korean people that the U.S. can't protect you because the U.S. doesn't have the will. The U.S. is a weak and impotent power. Whether that's a fact or whether it's just something they're going to use for their propaganda, it definitely is an attack that plays very well into the hands of the North Koreans.
Moving on to the Mideast, Benjamin Netanyahu's Likud party won a surprise victory in the recent Israeli elections. He'll continue as prime minister probably by forming a coalition with other right-wing parties. Interestingly, during the campaign, Netanyahu said he opposed the establishment of a Palestinian state. He'd previously supported it. And he said that he would continue to expand Israeli settlements on occupied Palestinian land. Does his position make a peace deal in Palestine virtually impossible?
I don't think necessarily because, I mean, as we can see during most election seasons in most countries, politicians seek to appeal to their base, and certainly the Likud base tends to be a little bit more extreme than the mainstream Israelis. And because the election appeared to be so close, he really wanted to demonstrate to the Likud party that he was the hard man. Netanyahu has shown a surprising amount of restraint in a lot of incidences that have taken place, including the recent ground war in Gaza. It took Netanyahu quite a while before he launched even an air campaign over Gaza, let alone a ground war. He really took his time, and this was something that really irked a lot of members of his party. It appealed to much more the mainstream Israeli political parties represented by the Zionist Union, because the Zionist Union represents more centrist parties. And, you know, he took a very pragmatic approach to the Palestinian state, but this did not appeal necessarily to his base. So I think a lot of this talk of, I will not allow a Palestinian state and all that stuff, really is just pandering to his base. He really can't afford to antagonize all of his Arab neighbors and alienate the Arab neighbors such as Jordan and Egypt, who are friends of Israel.
Now let's take a look at some developments in Europe. Earlier in March, approximately 3,000 soldiers from the U.S. 3rd Infantry Division's 1st Armored Brigade Combat Team arrived in Latvia with about 750 vehicles and pieces of heavy equipment, including tanks and fighting vehicles, artillery, and helicopters. These U.S. troops are to participate in live-fire joint training exercises with the Baltic Republics, Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia. It's part of a larger operation called Operation Atlantic Resolve, which was begun last year in response to Russia's annexation of Ukraine's Crimea. Marchand, can you explain to us where the Baltics are and what is their strategic importance?
Absolutely. Well, the Baltics are a set of countries along Russia's western border. They border the Barents Sea. They are Russia's key to the Atlantic. And what's very interesting is that the Baltics have historically been incredibly important to Russia. The Russians fought wars with the Swedes in the time of Peter the Great to have access to the ocean. In fact, probably the two most strategic locations for Russia as a nation have always been Crimea on the one hand and the Baltics on the other, because lest we forget, Peter the Great, Tsar Peter the Great, fought several wars with the Turks for control of Crimea and the Black Sea, and fought several wars with the Swedes over control of the Baltics. So the Baltics really is, as Peter the Great put it, Russia's window on the world. And without these strategic ports, Russia pretty much becomes a landlocked country. Most of Russia's northern bases off the coast of Finland and the Arctic region are iced in most of the year. And certainly Russia's eastern naval bases, such as Vladivostok, are also, if not iced in, but remote. In terms of trade, in terms of commerce, and in terms of their national security, the Baltics are very crucial, which is why Russia's always sought parts of the Baltic and the Crimea. And that's another point that our media and our politicians often forget, is that this is not a new Russian interest. This is not like Russia suddenly deciding, oh, you know, we want part of Alabama, you know, for some inexplicable reason. There's a very explicable reason, and it's the fact that the Russians have always fought for control of these territories. They fought the Turks and they fought the Swedes. And historically, they've either been part of Sweden or part of Turkey. The only other time they were independent of Russian rule, other than when they were under the Swedes and then under the Russians, was when they were under the Nazis. And that's one of the reasons why we see in a lot of these Baltic states an affinity for Nazism. And in fact, in Latvia, they were holding rallies for the Latvian SS. And there's a monument to the Latvian SS. And that really is what binds them with their Nazi past and what binds them with more or less right-wing militant nationalist movements is their anti-Russianness. And that's why a large portion of the populations in these Baltic states seem to be rallying together, is because they really don't want to be part of Russia again. They like being independent.
Now, if Russia were to attack the NATO countries, would the Baltics be a place to start?
Absolutely, because again, strategically for Russia, the Baltics are crucial. They're as crucial as Crimea is. And strategically speaking, politically speaking, and economically speaking, they are absolutely crucial for Russian security. And so it stands to reason that if they were to fight NATO, that would be the place to start.
Assuming there was a conventional war in the Baltics between NATO and Russia, what size ground force would be needed by NATO to meet a Russian attack?
it's very hard to understand often what the Russians' true military capabilities are. But the fact is that they can mobilize 400,000 troops in 48 hours. One of their snap drills, they mobilized 400,000 troops in 48 hours, somewhere in the ballpark of 900 tanks. It was an obscene number of personnel. So in essence, really, in order to meet the Russians head-to-head, realistically, we would need a 500,000 man army on the ground. Though I do not doubt the fighting spirit of our Eastern European or Baltic allies, they just don't have the military capacity to fight the Russians, nor do they necessarily have the training or adequate equipment to fight the Russians.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to the In Context War Report on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut. Streaming at WPKN.org. I'm Ken McDermott Rowe, your host, and I'm joined by Marshawn McDermott Rowe, our military affairs commentator. And right now we're talking about the buildup of NATO in the Baltic Republics and the possibility that the Russians might attack the Baltic Republics and how that might play out. Now, Marshawn, you had mentioned Russian snap drills. And after disappearing for 11 days, Vladimir Putin recently reemerged and announced a massive snap drill for the Russian military beginning on March the 16th. These exercises involve Russia's northern fleet and include 38,000 military personnel, 3,000 pieces of equipment, 41 ships, 15 submarines, and 110 airplanes and helicopters. The Russian defense minister said the main task of the drill is to assess the armed forces from the Northern Fleet's capabilities in fulfilling tasks in providing military security of Russia in the Arctic region. So, Marshawn, in your view, what is the purpose of the drill and what are the Russian objectives in the Arctic?
Well, I think fundamentally the purpose of the drill is to try to dissuade the West from a confrontation with Russia, because they're demonstrating openly their military capabilities. They're demonstrating their ability to mobilize large numbers of troops. But then I think also it is genuinely preparing for a conflict, because, well, we try to pretend that, you know, there will never be another major war. There will never be another world war. The Russians know better, because the Russians have been at the receiving end of almost every major world war, you know, not to, leaving aside alone World War One and World War Two, the Napoleonic Wars, the Crimean War, the Russo-Japanese War. I mean, they've been in a constant state of being battered by their neighbors. For them, the prospect of a major global war is a possibility. So I think part of it, too, is not only demonstrating their military capabilities to try to dissuade the West and try to intimidate their Baltic neighbors and the Ukrainians, but I think also part of it is truly preparing the military for what they believe is going to become an inevitable conflict.
With climate change, the Arctic is becoming warmer and it's becoming more navigable. Does this play a role in the importance of the Arctic to the Russians?
Absolutely. Well, there was an article I read on Russia Today that talked about part of their mobilization exercises included troops in their entire Arctic region. Now, the emphasis tended to be on the border with Finland and Norway, considering the Norwegians are holding a military exercise of their own. But this article in Russia Today talked about how it encompassed the entire Arctic region to include forces in central and eastern Russia. Now, the Arctic would give, especially if it does start to warm up a bit and become a bit more navigable, would allow the Russians much easier capabilities to launch a strike on Alaska via the Arctic. If they can sail submarines under the Arctic Circle, or if they could, you know, station troops in the Arctic Circle in preparation for a jump, if you will, into Alaska, it's a very real threat. And if we don't think the Russians might have their eyes on acquiring some former Tsarist territory, because let's not forget, Alaska was part of Russia up until it was sold by the Tsar to the United States.
Seward's folly.
Seward's folly, exactly, because it was considered a total waste of money when we bought it from them. But Putin had said, when he talked about the Novo Rus, the new Russia, what it encompassed, in an article in Newsweek, he said that it encompassed, first of all, ethnic Russians, secondly, Russian speakers, thirdly, the peoples of the former Soviet Union, and then fourthly, the lands of the former Tsarist Empire, which would include Alaska. Now, whether they would feasibly really want to take it or not is entirely up to debate, but the fact is that the Arctic is very important, because if they could launch a strike, and Alaska is fairly remote and not very densely populated, it could be a feasible target. We have to remember, the Russians are not all that far away. This is not like Nazi Germany where the war is over there. This is something antagonizing the Russians. We run the risk of really antagonizing an enemy that's pretty close to our shores.
The Western press almost trivialized Putin's disappearance before this drill was announced. Why did he disappear? Was it significant?
Putin, if he was going to disappear, he's very, very clever. And I think it was much more strategic than it was, and tactical than it was simply a matter of, oh, I have the flu. I think what it may have been is part of the preparation for these war games has been to disappear and try to see whether the West could find him, whether the Western intelligence agencies, who I'm sure they have their eyes on, were able to figure out where he was. Because in the event of war, the most important thing is for a leader to disappear. I mean, we shouldn't forget that Saddam Hussein disappeared the moment we began bombing Iraq, because the first thing we tried to do was blow him up. And so it would stand to reason that the first thing Putin would want to do to maintain uncertainty in the West would be to disappear in the event of war.
And maybe he would go to some very secure command post where he could discreetly organize the Russian military.
It is entirely possible that what he could have done is gone to a bunker somewhere in the Urals and practiced command, you know, how he would operate his command and control networks from there.
Now, NATO's confrontation with Russia brings us to the Ukraine. As we've reported, the elected pro-Russian Ukrainian government was overthrown early last year in a U.S.-backed coup. Soon thereafter, the ethnic Russian community in eastern Ukraine revolted and has attempted to set up a separate republic. The separatists are backed by Russia, while the government in Kiev receives aid from the United States. Last month, we reported that General Ben Hodges of the U.S. Army Europe Commander announced that a U.S. battalion will be deployed to the Ukraine to train troops there. In addition, the Ukraine government recently announced a schedule for joint military exercises with U.S. troops this year. These exercises require the consent of the Ukraine Parliament. Now, Marshawn, what is the present military situation in the Ukraine? Is there a lot of fighting going on?
Well, right now, the Minsk Treaty, by and large, seems to be holding. I mean, you still have, you know, scattered attacks, the occasional Ukrainian soldier killed here or there, unknown numbers killed on the rebel side here or there. The intensity has really gone down, and the agreement does seem, at least for the time being, to be holding. But I can't imagine this is going to last much longer, especially when spring comes, and spring will be the prime time for an offensive in Ukraine.
Now, Marshawn, as the U.S. increases its support for the Ukraine military, we want to take a special look at a unit within the Ukraine Army known as the Azov Battalion because of its very interesting background connections. Marshawn, could you explain the political connections of the Ukraine Army's Azov Battalion?
Well, absolutely. The Azov Battalion is more or less a collection of neo-Nazis. In fact, there was a reporter from the Associated Press who went and interviewed members of the Azov Battalion who openly claimed to be Nazis. And if there's any doubt of this connection, you just have to look at the emblem of the Azov Battalion, which is the SS Wolfsangel. It is the symbol of the former Das Reich division of the SS. The entity in of itself is also connected to the Ukrainian right sector headed by Dmitry Yarosh. The Ukrainian right sector is an openly neo-Nazi party. It was involved very heavily in the overthrow of the Ukrainian government. And its members during the rebellion had the numbers 8-8 on their helmets for Heil Hitler, the eighth letter in the alphabet being the letter H. So, and they also had SS runes on their helmets and swastikas.
And as I understand it, their roots do go back to the collaborationists during World War II.
That is absolutely true. Their roots go back, at least as they claim, to Stepan Bandera. Now, Stepan Bandera was a Nazi collaborator, militantly anti-Russian, although much of his history is obscured, by and large because NATO protected him at the end of the war because he headed a Ukrainian independence committee. Now, Stepan Bandera was eventually murdered by the KGB, but he had been very useful in his time as an anti-Soviet agent. But the fact is he was a Nazi collaborator, and there are statues to Stepan Bandera in Ukraine. But we can't forget is that he was a Nazi. He was a Nazi collaborator, and his supporters ended up going on to become members and leaders of the right sector in these militant neo-Nazi movements within Ukraine.
Now, we come to a very bizarre connection, not just to the neo-Nazis, but to the rebellion in Chechnya and a connection with Islamic extremism. Could you talk about where is Chechnya, what is the fighting there all about, and how do Ukrainian right-wingers end up connected with the Chechen rebels?
Chechnya is a country in the Caucasus. There's a very important Russian oil pipeline that travels through it. But strategically speaking, it's always been a very important country to the Russians. They've always sought to control Chechnya. And the Chechens have always fought for their independence from Russian rule. The Chechens are a European population, but predominantly Muslim. At this stage, have seemed to become more resigned to Russian rule. They became independent from Russia, truly independent, in 1991 when the Soviet Union collapsed. And their first president was Dzhokhar Dudayev. Eventually, the republic fell apart. They were invaded by Russia. And they fought a brutal series of wars for their independence, ultimately culminating in Russian domination. What seemed to have resulted in the dying down of the Chechen independence movement was not simply the killing of their leaders, but rather the injection of militant Islam, militant Wahhabism into Chechnya. Now, the Chechens were always very devout Muslims, but they were not militants. They are not militants. Chechnya is not a militant-friendly country. And there was an injection of militancy which came from the Arab world in the form of foreign fighters into Chechnya to fight against the Russians. And when this militant form of Islam started to appear, it seemed in many ways that the Chechen resistance movement, the secular resistance movement, died down and sort of seemed to merge with the collaborator pro-Russian Chechen government that's in power now. And the resistance molded into more of an Islamic fundamentalist resistance without a whole lot of support from the mainstream Chechen people. Now, what's interesting is that the Chechens themselves, they don't have a desire to perform suicide bombings in Russia and, you know, massacre Russian soldiers and commit acts of genocide. However, the militant Wahhabis do. Now, there is an interesting connection here, because who comes over to fight alongside these militant Wahhabis but members of the right sector? Dmitry Yarosh and the former senior honcho in the right sector, Oleksandr Mushko, came to Chechnya along with numerous other volunteers to fight the Russians. Actually, Alexander Mushko and, I believe, to my knowledge, Dmitry Yarosh are wanted by the Russian government for war crimes committed in Chechnya. Wahhabi elements have found common cause with these right sector militants. A unit called the Dzhokhar Dudayev Battalion was found, made up of all Chechens, was found to be fighting in Debaltseve against the Russians. And we knew this because their commander was killed in Debaltseve during the fighting.
And this is a very important battle. There were 8,000 government troops, that's troops of the central government, Kiev, who were surrounded and eventually defeated by the separatists. What, talk about Issa Muniyev.
Issa Muniyev was the commander of the Dzhokhar Dudayev battalion killed in the fighting in Debaltseve. Now, he had been a member of the Chechen resistance during the First and Second Chechen War. But what's interesting is he fought for the same Chechen Republic as men like Shamil Basayev, who went on to become a militant Wahhabi. So we see connections here between these militant Islamists and the Dzhokhar Dudayev battalion, because these men fought together. Now, how well they knew each other, whether simply they were members of the same army, is anybody's guess at this stage. But it can be argued that since they fought together and they're both clearly militantly anti-Russian, that they collaborated with each other on more than simply just their dislike of the Russians. And now that they're going to Ukraine to fight alongside members of the right sector, their brothers, as they call them, from Ukraine, who came to fight for them. And that's the other interesting connection, is they refer to their Ukrainian brothers who fought for them during the First and Second Chechen War. Well, those would be the members of the right sector, the militant neo-Nazis.
Once again, we're seeing that despite the U.S. claimed war on Islamic militants, we often find ourselves aligned with them. That certainly happened in Afghanistan in the 1980s, where we used the Mujahideen as our tool. And of course, Al-Qaeda evolved from that group as our tool to fight the Russians in Afghanistan. We used them in Yugoslavia in the 1990s, in Libya in 2011, when we overthrew Gaddafi, we were allied with the Islamic fighting group, or jihadist group. And then in Syria with the al-Nusra Front, we've been trying to use them to topple Assad, and we're in this rather bizarre position where we're proclaiming we're fighting them, but our real goal is to overthrow Assad at the same time. And of course, we share that goal with the jihadists in Syria. As we discuss this, I want listeners to understand we're not conservatives or liberals. We're not coming at this from a partisan point of view. We're just trying to point out the reality of American foreign policy, its military policy, and demonstrate some of the inherent contradictions and irrationality of this policy, and hope that it'll provoke a discussion and a reexamination of our foreign policy so that we can come up with one that better serves the interests of the American nation and the American people.
There's a real danger once you support any extremist group of any banner, it will come back to burn you.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to the In Context War Report on WPKN, 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming at WPKN.org. I'm Ken McDermott Rowe, your host, and I'm joined by Marshawn McDermott Rowe, our military affairs commentator. Our producer, Gus Canavero, who usually joins us, is away on assignment. We've just been talking about the situation in Ukraine and the bizarre collaboration between the United States and Ukrainian military forces, which include the Azov Battalion with its very strong ties to the jihadists in Chechnya. The In Context War Report is broadcast on the fourth Monday of the month at noon. To download a copy of the show and sign up for podcasts, visit our website, incontextreport.com. Shows are also available through iTunes and are archived at WPKN.org and Radio for All. You can watch our videos on the In Context Report YouTube channel, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and write to us at ken@mdrtalk.org. Over the past year, the militant and Islamist group known as the Islamic State conquered large parts of Iraq, including the northern city of Mosul. Now the Iraq army, with the support of Shia militia and Iranian military, as well as U.S. airstrikes, are fighting to regain control of the Iraqi city of Tikrit. Marshawn, how is the battle for Tikrit going?
It did look like a while ago that the city of Tikrit was ready to fall, but it turned out that hasn't been the case. It still has yet to fall fully into government hands. So right now, it just seems to have devolved into a slogging match between ISIS on one hand, the Iraqi army, Shia militias, and Iranian special forces on the other.
How important is the contribution of the Iran military and the Shia militia in this offensive against Tikrit?
It is very crucial because right now the only substantive support that the Iraqis have at this stage on the ground in combat, I'm not talking about the U.S. forces that are involved in a training role, but the U.S. forces that are involved in combat, the most substantive role is being contributed at this stage by the Iranians, because the Iranians are committing more than just a handful of special forces. Not to put down in any way the contribution of our special forces, they're contributing immensely, but rather just to say that the Iranians are also contributing larger numbers of troops than we are to the actual fighting. And that has made a difference in the recent advances of the Iraqi army. But what, in my opinion, is holding the advance back is the fact there seems to be no coordination with U.S. forces as to the attack on Tikrit. The fact that the U.S. seems to be very afraid to contribute, because if there's a victory, we're afraid the Iranians might take it as, we won and this will extend Iranian influence. But it's a catch-22, because if we don't do anything and they eventually take the city, well, then the Iranians will seem the heroes because we didn't do anything. And if we don't do anything and they don't take the city, the Iranians will still seem the heroes because the only reason they lost was because we refused to contribute.
This follows up from a point that you raised a couple months ago on the In Context Report and an editorial in the Army Times, that the United States should be practical and cooperate with Iran in opposing ISIS, since we share our antipathy towards the jihadists of the Islamic State. In fact, they are Sunni radicals who want to exterminate the Shia. And the Iranians, of course, are Shia. So far, our government is at best ambivalent about Iranian support. In fact, we seem to not want it, even though it's the most logical place to turn.
Sometimes you have to make friends of convenience, because let's face it, I mean, we allied ourselves with the Soviet Union so that we could fight the Japanese and the Germans and the Italians during World War II. The fact is that while Iran might be something we're going to have to deal with down the road, ISIS is a greater threat. Right now, ISIS is spreading like an infection. They've had Boko Haram in Nigeria swear allegiance to ISIS. They have had the Pakistani Taliban swear allegiance to ISIS. The Afghani Taliban may swear allegiance to ISIS. Members of the so-called Free Syrian Army, which is more or less the Free Syrian ISIS at this stage, have been defecting in large numbers to ISIS. ISIS is the much bigger threat. If this means we have to cut a deal for now with the Iranians, we have to work with the Iranians, with the Syrians, and definitely with the Russians and the Europeans on this, we need to. We can deal with Iran later. We can't deal with ISIS later, because the longer we let ISIS fester, the more of a threat it's going to become. And the more we dither, unlike Iran, unlike Syria, unlike Russia even, ISIS wants to blow us up. They want to commit acts of terrorism inside the U.S. They want to, if they can, get a dirty bomb inside the U.S. We are at the greatest peril we have ever been in. And we seem to be staring this threat in the face, saying, oh, we don't really like the Iranians. Well, we didn't like the Soviets either.
Whose interests are being served by the American foreign policy? You take, say, Saddam Hussein, who was certainly an autocrat, but he was our ally in the 1980s, a very strong ally of the Reagan administration. And he was not exporting terrorism. And now we suggest that he was, but in fact, he was not supporting terrorism. There was never, that charge was never made against him at the time we tried to justify our invasion. But we removed him from office and created a vacuum in which terrorists came. And now in Syria, we have Assad, another autocrat, but he was tolerant of other religions. He was not exporting terrorism. And it is still our purpose to overthrow him. And what's likely to come out of that but more jihadist militants in charge of part of the country, if not the entire country? What's the rationale behind this policy, I wonder?
The Obama administration, they don't like ISIS, but they don't want to see ISIS lose, but they don't want to see him win either. ISIS plays a very useful role for the administration because on the one hand, it keeps the Iranian influence out of Iraq. On the other hand, it puts pressure on Syria. I think more than anything, this administration's agenda is anti-Russian. Really, the Obama administration doesn't care as much about Iran. They don't really care about ISIS, but what they care about is the fact that ISIS is anti-Russian and anti-Assad. If Assad gets toppled, we'll deal with the jihadists later. There was actually a story that came out from the CIA where they said that we were kind of worried about what will fill the vacuum. Maybe we should live with Assad because what will fill the vacuum if a ISIS type or jihadist organization comes in and takes Damascus? And that is the real danger. But the Obama administration doesn't seem to see that. The Obama administration seems to be focused very heavily on, we want to get Assad out of power, we want to get the Russians out of Syria, we want to get the Russians out of their naval base in Tartus, which is Russia's only naval base on the Mediterranean at this stage, and then we'll deal with ISIS later. If ISIS loses, well, then Assad will become strengthened, the Russian position in Syria will become strengthened, the Russian position in Iran, because let's not forget, Iran is a Russian proxy, the Russian position in Iran will become strengthened. So more than anything, I think this administration's goal is to be anti-Russian. If that means we have to tolerate ISIS for a little while, we will tolerate them. But that's a very dangerous policy because Russia does not want to bomb New York. ISIS does.
Look at the record. Afghanistan, there was a secular government in Afghanistan allied with Russia. And we worked for years with the Mujahideen to overthrow it. And what did we get? We got an Islamic State. And now we've attempted to overthrow it. But eventually it looks like it's going to be back in power. And in Libya, we overthrew Gaddafi because he was allied with Russia. He'd thrown the U.S. out when he took over back in the late 1960s. So we did get rid of him. But what's happened? The country's devolved into anarchy with fighting between various Muslim militant groups, and it looks like a very fertile place for ISIS to expand. So these policies, we don't seem to learn anything from our past policy mistakes.
We use very short-term thinking, and eventually it comes back to kill Americans. And that's what I really want to emphasize to our audience here, more than anything, is these mistakes, we can forget about them today, but maybe in 5 years, in 6 years, in 7 years, in 10 years, it will come back to bite us.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to the In Context War Report on WPKN, 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming at WPKN.org. I'm Ken McDermott Rowe, your host, and I'm joined by Marshawn McDermott Rowe, our military affairs commentator. And we've just been talking about the fighting that's been going on around Tikrit in Iraq, what it implies for our relationships with Iran, and generally been reviewing the inconsistencies, the lack of success in our foreign policy as it relates to our war against terrorism, against jihadists. Now, President Obama has been criticized particularly by Republicans for his reluctance to talk about Islam as it relates to the war on terror. So I'd like to take a few minutes to discuss Islam with you, Marshawn, especially the variety of Islam that's promoted by the Islamic State or espoused by the Islamic State as it relates to the conflicts in Iraq and Syria and elsewhere around the world. So let's begin with some important background. Marshawn, could you briefly describe what are the important tenets of Islam and how does Islam differ from Christianity?
Fundamentally, all three Abrahamic religions are one following and building after the other. Judaism, Christianity, and Islam are all very fundamentally similar religions. But in terms of especially Christianity and Islam, the only major differences are that Muslims do not believe in the divinity of Jesus. They do not believe that he was the Son of God. But Muslims also don't believe that Jesus died on the cross, but rather that he was raised up to heaven before the crucifixion and is to come again to defeat the Antichrist, which is the same, a very similar story as to the Bible. The Bible also teaches that Jesus will come again to fight the Antichrist. Muslims believe that Jesus will come again. Muslims also believe in the Immaculate Conception and that the Virgin Mary was in fact a virgin. And fundamentally, the tenets of Islam, Christianity, and Judaism are very, very similar. I had an Islamic scholar once say to me that Christianity is Judaism plus Jesus, and Islam is Judaism and Christianity plus Muhammad. And in many ways, that's a very true statement. When you read the Torah, when you read the Bible, and then if you read the Quran, you see there's a lot of similarities. The religions are far more similar than they are dissimilar.
And when you say that they're both Abrahamic religions, actually the ancestor of the Arabs, Ishmael, was Abraham's firstborn son.
Exactly. And the ancestor of the Jews was Isaac. And so the religions are fundamentally intertwined. It's not like the difference between, let's say, Hinduism and Christianity. Islam and Christianity, Islam and Judaism are religions that are all born of each other. But the differences that truly separate Islam and Christianity and Islam and Judaism is politics, because the banner of militant Islam has very little to do with what the Quran actually teaches. It has about as much to do with what the Quran teaches as militants of, let's say, the Hindu faith who go and murder Christians or Muslims in India.
Well, now, Marshawn, we hear a lot in the media over the years about this conflict between the Sunnis and the Shias. What is the difference between the two? How does a variety of Islam associated with the Islamic State fit into that split?
The difference is fundamentally between the Sunni and the Shia is political rather than theological. I mean, they follow different schools of thought, but there are multiple schools of thought within Sunni Islam in of itself. So, but there aren't any theological differences. The only real difference is political. It's who should have been the successor after the Prophet Muhammad. And that really is the main difference. It stems in brief from a civil war in Islam when the followers of Ali, who was the son-in-law of the Prophet Muhammad, fought against the followers of Muawiyah, who claimed to be the new leader of the Muslim world, or wanted to be the new leader of the Muslim world. And so that really was where the split began. And it's kind of reverberated to this day. But theologically, there is no difference.
From a Christian perspective, you might say it's similar to the difference between the Roman Catholic Church and the Eastern Orthodox churches. The Roman Catholic Church, of course, is headed by the Bishop of Rome, the Pope, whereas the Eastern Orthodox churches have a variety of patriarchs and they don't recognize the supremacy of the Pope, the Bishop of Rome.
You hit the nail right on the head. That is precisely it. The two sects, as it were, but they're not really sects. They're more or less schools of thought, as the Eastern Orthodox Church and the Catholic Church are two different schools of thought rather than sects. The Sunnis and the Shia fundamentally live together by and large. You know, there have been political wars, but again, they've been political wars over who's going to lead the Muslim world, but they haven't been theological wars. The militants, the Wahhabis, come out of the Sunni school of thought, and they follow a very medieval interpretation of Islam known as Wahhabism, which was founded by Muhammad ibn Abdul Wahhab in the 18th century in Saudi Arabia. Now, Wahhabism would have disappeared into the Saudi Peninsula a very long time ago, were it not for the end of the Ottoman Empire. When the Ottoman Empire fell, the Saudi royal family came to power by merit of the fact that they got the support of the Wahhabis. And they said, you know, we will propagate your school of thought if you help us get power. And that was how Wahhabism, which was an alien concept in Islam, began to spread across the Middle East. And it's appealed by and large to illiterate populations, because anybody who's ever read the Quran can say that, well, this doesn't make any sense. You know, the idea that women have to cover head to toe and can't even show their eyes. Well, there's nothing in the Quran that says that. In fact, the only reference to women covering anything at all is it says women must guard their modesty. And the reason why the headscarf was prescribed was because that was something that in the time of the Prophet Muhammad was done. And moreover, it was something condoned by the Prophet Muhammad as being a good thing. But in terms of women covering themselves head to toe and covering their eyes, there is nothing in the Quran that says that they have to do that. That is this very medieval tribal interpretation of Islam that is taken from the from the Wahhabis.
They're not an urban people, I'm guessing, in their origins?
No, they come out of the Bedouins, who are a tribal people. They inhabited the deserts in the interior of Saudi Arabia, and they lived in tents, really, up until the fall of the Ottoman Empire, when they rose to take over the Saudi Peninsula. That was really when they became a bit more urbanized, but they never shed their Wahhabi ways. They never shed their tribal ways. And that is why they tend to put this very medieval interpretation. Much of the laws, when you look at it, Saudi Arabia, are not fundamentally Islamic laws. They're fundamentally Wahhabi laws. They're a medieval interpretation of Islam, but they're not in any way, shape, or form a correct interpretation of Islam.
So when we speak of the Islamic State and the religion that it's espousing, we're talking mainly about Wahhabism. So can we talk about some important questions that would arise to a Westerner? You hear the phrase kill all infidels associated with jihadists. Is this something that reflects mainstream Islamic thinking? Is it in accord with the Quran?
Not at all. The Quran does not say go and kill all the people who disagree with you. The word the Quran uses for a quote-unquote infidel is not the word infidel. The word infidel was actually coined during the Crusades to mean inferior faith. But the word in the Quran is kafir. Now, kafir translates as unbeliever, one who does not believe. First, before you understand the word unbeliever, you must understand the word mu'min, which is the word believer. The Quran defines what is a believer. A believer is anyone who believes in the oneness of God. Above all things, it is one who believes in the oneness of God. And included amongst the believers are the people of the book, which it defines as the Christians, the Jews, and then the Muslims, all the people of the book. And then, so then you have to look towards, okay, what is an unbeliever? Well, the polytheists, those who persecute others regardless of their religion are considered unbelievers. Those who deny God and things like that are considered unbelievers. But it doesn't say that just because they're unbelievers, you should kill them. It says that if somebody wages war, a war of aggression against you or against somebody who can't protect themselves, your neighbor, if your neighbor is a Christian or a Jew or a Muslim, it doesn't matter. If somebody wages a war of aggression against your neighbor, it is incumbent upon you to protect them. Now, let's say your neighbor is a Christian and the person attacking them is a Muslim. You must ally yourself with the Christian to protect them because they are the weaker one. And the Muslim who is the aggressor, he has now become an unbeliever because he has defied God. He has ceased to be a believer because the God commands that you shall not fight wars against those that are weaker than you. You shall not fight wars of aggression. I've talked about the definition of an unbeliever and what makes someone an unbeliever. There is a verse in the Quran where it says, where you see an unbeliever, in essence, you are to fight him and kill him. People take that verse out of context. As much the extremists as anybody else, the extremists like to take that verse and say, see, it says kill all unbelievers, but that's not what it's saying. The context of the verse, if you read the entire surah, which is the entire chapter, it is talking about war. And preceding that verse is talking about anyone waging a war of aggression becomes an unbeliever. So on the battlefield, when you are fighting against the unbelievers, because you are never supposed to fight against a believer, against an innocent person, against a weaker person, or an unbeliever who is not waging a war against you, all war must be defensive. So in the context, when waging a defensive war on the battlefield, you are to kill the enemy, is in essence what it is saying. The first commandments of the Prophet Muhammad, when going into battle, the first battle in Islamic history, the Battle of Badr, the Prophet Muhammad commanded, you shall not harm the women, you shall not harm the children, you shall not harm the man who works in the field, you shall not cut down trees, and you shall not kill prisoners. In fact, the whole concept of executing prisoners is haram, which means absolutely forbidden. And to kill a prisoner or an unarmed person is a sin, an incredible, grievous sin in Islam.
The conduct of the Islamic State in places like Iraq, where they're rounding people up, Christians, and executing them and engaging, as I understand, in compulsory conversions, how does the rest of the Muslim world view that? What position are they taking?
The rest of the Muslim world is absolutely appalled by it. Now, I always hear pundits on television saying, oh, well, why doesn't the Muslim world stand up and do more? The Muslim world is. In fact, every great Islamic scholar has come out, whether it is in Al-Azhar, whether it is in Mecca, whether it is in Bosnia-Herzegovina, Indonesia, Malaysia, China, Korea, Germany, or Britain, or America. Every single leading Islamic scholar, the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, came out and condemned ISIS as being unbelievers because of the crimes that they are committing. The crimes that they are committing are un-Islamic, and it is incumbent upon Muslims to fight against ISIS. And that's why so many Muslim nations have come to the banner against ISIS. One of the things that you also see as an effect of this is that the followers of ISIS, by the knock-on effect, the followers of ISIS are the ignorant people, those who, now they're not ignorant because, well, they just don't have jobs and, you know, no, that's not the reason. They're ignorant because they come from poor countries where, you know, warfare has been more important than learning how to read and write. That's the societies they come from, places like Yemen, Afghanistan, Iraq, places like that. They rally around the banner of anti-Americanism. There were several former Western hostages that had been released by ISIS because the government paid the ransoms. And they said that their captors had never read the Quran, that they didn't know verses from the Quran. In fact, the Quran says there is no compulsion in religion. It says in the Quran, in black and white, there is no compulsion in religion. If you force somebody to convert, you're committing a grievous sin against Islam.
Marshawn, in your travels, have you had the opportunity to converse with people who've espoused jihadism? And what was your thoughts about their grasp of the Muslim religion?
In my travels, I spent a lot of time in Egypt, and what was absolutely fascinating was I met people from all walks of life, educated, uneducated. And one of the things that struck me is the people who espoused jihadist ideologies were by and large very, very ignorant. I would have conversations with them where they would say, Americans should convert to Islam. They should become Muslim. We must make them become Muslim. And I'd say, what do you mean you must make them become Muslim? That's the Quran says there's no compulsion in religion. And they would give me sort of a blank look, like this was new information to them. Nobody had ever told this to them before. And the response would sort of be, what do you mean? That no, they must. And I'd say, no, the Quran says it. And it became very clear to me that this person had never really read the Quran. He'd gone to some meeting of some organization, I'm guessing, or some group of people who agreed with his ideology, and they said, well, this is what we all believe. But the fact is that he didn't know these fundamental tenets of Islam. And I said, well, you know, the Christians and the Jews are the people of the book, read the Quran. And it was completely new information. On the other hand, I would converse with very educated Egyptians who go, well, of course, these guys are completely nuts. These Muslim Brotherhood guys, they're totally out of their mind. My neighbor's a Christian, or my employee or my boss is a Christian. They lived and worked alongside Christians and alongside Shiites. And they're saying, why would any rational human being who's ever read the Quran think this? So yes. I've gotten to meet people from both walks of life, and it is very striking to see the difference. But the one thing that seemed to unite those who espoused a more jihadist ideology universally was an ignorance of Islam and an ignorance of the Quran, and secondly, a very strong political conviction in anti-Americanism. They hated America. That was the one thing they were certain of. It was almost like, well, okay, maybe you're right about the thing in the Quran, but America is bad. You know, that was still
Marshawn, do you think that the support they're picking up around the Mideast in particular, places like the Sinai in Egypt or in other countries, that they're harnessing anti-colonialism, particular anti-Americanism, and that it has less to do with the details of their philosophy or their attitudes on education or women, but more to do that they want to get rid of the colonialists, and the Islamic State seems to be the best horse to ride in that regard?
I think in many ways, yes, it is the banner of anti-Americanism, anti-Westernism, the old anti-colonialist game. It's really, that's what has become their uniting factor, because in many ways, they just see Wahhabism or militant Islam as the sort of the thing to fight the West, as they found so more or less socialism, or, you know, in the banner of Gamal Abdel Nasser, or Baathism in the banner of Saddam Hussein, as the way of fighting the West back in the 60s. Now it is the banner of, amongst the ignorant people, of militant Islam. But that's also why you don't see a ISIS army marching on Cairo. You don't see an ISIS insurrection in Helwan, Egypt, because the urban populations of Egypt and the urban populations of the Arab world and the Muslim world in general are appalled by what they see, because it's an ideology for either the ignorant on the one hand or the politically expedient on the other, because the leaders of ISIS may be able to read and write, and they're smart people. They are very smart people. They're probably the most dangerous terrorists we've ever faced because they're so smart. But the leadership of ISIS, they know they're lying. They know what they're saying about Islam is wrong. They know that what they're commanding their people to do is wrong, but they know it's going to get them power.
Excuse me, Marshawn, if you just tuned in, you're listening to the In Context War Report on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming at WPKN.org. I'm Ken McDermott Rowe, your host. I'm joined by Marshawn McDermott Rowe, our military affairs commentator. In these last few minutes of the show, we've been talking about the variety of Islam that's espoused by the Islamic State, its Wahhabi connections, it's stemming from Saudi Arabia, and whether these militants actually reflect a correct reading of the Quran or mainstream Islam. Now, Marshawn, one of the features of the Islamic State is they claim they're going to reestablish the caliphate. And as I understand it, the caliphate last existed with the Ottoman Empire, which disintegrated following World War I. That is, the caliphate ended in the 1920s. How would you compare their form of Islam with the Islam and the characteristics of the Ottoman Empire?
Comparing the characteristics of the Ottoman Empire with the Islamic State would be tantamount to comparing the actions of the Serbs in Bosnia-Herzegovina with those of Emperor Constantine. The Ottoman Empire was a very progressive state. It was an Islamic-based state, but it was very modern. It was very forward-thinking. And at one point in history, it had been the center of Western learning and preserved a lot of the literature that had been lost during the fall of the Roman Empire, and a lot of the knowledge that had been lost during the fall of the Roman Empire was preserved by the Ottomans. Now, when the Ottoman state fell apart, there was grasping in the Muslim world for some kind of unity, something to bring the Muslim nations together again in this sort of glorious renaissance. That's one of the reasons why the developed societies, the developed and educated Muslim societies, find the Islamic State so repugnant, because I think a lot of Muslims would like to see an Ottoman-style caliphate, a modern caliphate, something that unites the Arab nations or the Muslim nations, but is modern, progressive, is the center of science and learning. But then they look at the Islamic State, and that's not a caliphate. That's not what the Muslim world, that's not like anything that's ever existed in the Muslim world prior to now. It's a very bizarre sort of anomaly in that they claim they are the leaders of the Islamic world, but the path they follow is the complete opposite of the Abbasids, the Umayyads, the Ottomans, and all the previous caliphates that had existed.
Speaking of anomalies, Marshawn, do you think that our leaders in Congress have any concept of the implications of the Wahhabi ties of our so-called strongest Arab ally, Saudi Arabia?
The problem is that our leaders tend to take a very two-dimensional look towards what's going on in the Middle East. You know, it's just that there are good Muslims that like America and there are bad Muslims who don't. Well, it doesn't really work that way. It's a lot more complicated. Just because the Saudis pretend to like us doesn't mean these aren't the same guys who are arming and funding ISIS. The same with the Gulf states. The people, we forget that it's not simply that these countries just, you know, like the socialist bloc, they were those socialists that we could kind of live with and the communists that we couldn't live with. The problem is that you have the heart of Wahhabism in Saudi Arabia, which is sponsoring ISIS. And then meanwhile, we're turning our backs on General El-Sisi, well, now President El-Sisi in Egypt, who is a secularist. He's a Muslim. He's a secularist. And, you know, King Abdullah of Jordan, who's a Muslim, but he's, you know, a secularist, a modern leader. And we're turning our backs on them, but we're still funding and helping the Saudis, who are also funding and helping ISIS. And a lot of that's because we don't understand that the problem is, it's much more than just on the surface. Yes, King Salman of Saudi Arabia might on the one hand shake our hand, but he's still funneling money to ISIS. Whereas on the other hand, Egypt is not. Egypt might like the Russians, but we can live with a secular country that likes the Russians. We can't live with ISIS. And I think part of the problem is the leaders in our country really don't understand the difference between Wahhabism and secular Islam. They just understand that there are terrorists and non-terrorists. I think that's about as far as most of our politicians understand the concept.
Well, thank you very much, Marshawn, for that background information. And that's it for this edition of the In Context War Report. The In Context War Report is produced by MDR Productions, Inc. and is broadcast at noon on the fourth Monday of the month on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming at WPKN.org. This program will be archived at WPKN.org, at RadioForAll.org, and on our show's website, incontextreport.com. And you can sign up for podcasts of the series via iTunes and Radio For All and through our website, incontextreport.com. Like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and write to us at ken@mdrtalk.org. On behalf of In Context Military Affairs commentator Marshawn McDermott Rowe, this is your host, Ken McDermott Rowe. Thanks for listening. See you next time.
See ya.